Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Business Movers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. It's the 1960s on the University of Colorado campus in Boulder, in the office of the Reserve Army Training Corps, or the ROTC. A young college student, a cadet, stands at attention as the head of the ROTC walks in the room.
Sit down, son.
Yes, sir.
As the young man sits, he knows he's in big trouble. He's been struggling with his grades and his behavior. Recently, he got into a violent altercation with a commanding officer. Now he's been called to the head of the ROTC to receive his punishment.
Do you want to tell me what happened, son?
He stepped on my shoe, sir.
You're going to have to do better than that.
We were in the middle of an inspection at the quadrangle. He got in my face and told me my shoes weren't polished, but they were. When I pointed that out, he stepped on them, scuffed them up, and sent me off to redo them. When I came back, he was bullying one of my fellow cadets.
And that's when you said...
The officer reaches for a piece of paper.
Hey, asshole, why don't you pick on someone your own size?
Yes, sir.
And then you assaulted him. That behavior is not becoming of a cadet.
I understand that, sir, but I'd like you to hear my side of the story.
There's only one side of the story, son.
When I came back, he was pressing his boot on my friend's ankle. My friend was crying out in pain, begging him to stop.
I'm sorry, son, but you assaulted a commanding officer. I can't have you in this program.
But, sir,
you're done. And that'll be all. You're dismissed.
The young cadet was expelled from the ROTC program. Worried for his future, the young man's grandfather reached out to a family contact and secured him an internship at a Wall Street firm called Lehman Brothers. The young man didn't fit in at the ROTC, but he thrived on the trading floor. He would later say, "I truly stumbled into investment banking. Once I got exposed to it, I discovered that all the pieces fit." Soon, the young man, Richard Dick Fuld, would put the pieces together and secure a full-time job at Lehman, climb to the top of the corporate ladder, and forever change the face of Wall Street, for better or worse.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.
From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is Business Movers. Dick Fuld had an aggressive personality and a big appetite for risk. These traits earned him a fitting nickname, the Gorilla. Dick embraced it. He liked it so much that he kept a stuffed gorilla in his office at work. Over the course of his decades-long career at Lehman, Dick's ferocious mentality helped him rise to become CEO. When Dick took the top job in 1994, the once-vaunted firm was in decline. The year Dick took over, Lehman had only $75 million in earnings and a return on equity of around 2%. By 2005, just over 10 years into Dick's tenure as CEO, Lehman had $32 billion in revenue, over $3 billion in profits and over 19% in return on equity. But the massive growth was built in part on a house of cards that came crashing down in the wake of the subprime mortgage crisis. As CEO, Dick had vigorously pursued real estate, even in the face of warning signs that the market was in trouble. In the end, Lehman would not survive the crisis, but Dick still profited handsomely. During his tenure at Lehman, Dick received over $500 million in total compensation. In 2007, the year before Lehman declared bankruptcy, his total compensation was over $22 million. Dick quickly became, as one writer put it, a poster boy for the naked avarice of Wall Street. Here to take us inside the mind of Dick Fuld and into the belly of Lehman Brothers is that same writer, Vicky Ward, author of The Devil's Casino, Friendship, Betrayal, and the High Stakes Games Played Inside Lehman Brothers. Here's our conversation. Vicky Ward, thank you so much for talking with me on Business Movers.
Thank you for having me, Lindsay.
As Lehman's CEO, Dick Fuld took the firm to new heights, but his appetite for risk helped pull Lehman down into the depths. In your estimation, is Dick the villain of the Lehman story, or is it more complicated than that?
It's definitely more complicated. You know, I haven't read my own book for a long, long time. It came out in 2010. And I was struck sort of all these years later, rereading it, at just how sort of complicated and tragic a figure that Dick Fuld really is. He started out in the commercial paper unit. He was an instinctive trader. He was a taciturn guy when he first got to Wall Street. He realized over the years and through the various challenges that if he was going to become the CEO of an institution that had, you know, more than just fixed income, more than just sort of bond trading, he would have to change himself. He copied this sort of legendary investment banker, Tom Hill. But Tom Hill went to all the right schools, wore all the right clothes. That wasn't who Dick Fuld was originally. He was scrappy, you know, and Lehman was known for being scrappy. But Dick Fuld worked really hard on transforming himself and sort of copying Tom Hill, who eventually was kicked out of Lehman, leaving room for Dick Fuld to ascend to the top. Dick worked really hard on becoming the outside guy, on becoming somebody who could be good with clients, on traveling more, on becoming more of an extrovert. And in some ways, the great irony of that is that as the book heads into the 2000s and we head towards the financial crisis of 2008, his big Achilles heel is that he's so often on a plane and he's so busy dealing with outside clients and trying to build the business and, you know, being very bullish, that he does something that he has not been comfortable doing, partly out of insecurity. For many, many years, he appoints a successor, a president of Lehman Brothers, and delegates the running of the business to that guy. And whilst Dick Fuld is on a plane with clients bringing in outside business, the problems for Lehman really start to build because the president, who Dick has handpicked and chosen and therefore does have to take responsibility for, is not sufficiently focused. But it's a complicated, actually rather sad story of someone who I think really did try to do the right thing and delegated to the wrong person. That was the big mistake.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the big mistake or the subject of it. I assume we're talking about President Joe Gregory.
Correct.
What was his role then? If he wasn't watching the store properly, what was he watching?
So, you know, Joe Gregory was very big on diversity and inclusion, you know, very laudable things, possibly ahead of his time, actually. After the firm survived 9/11, and remember their offices were in the World Trade Center, and for them to survive and turn around and carry on business almost as usual within 24 hours was something that brought them a lot of respect. Joe Gregory, I think, was a very charismatic man, and Lehman's high profile that it garnered for its effort in promoting women and diversity and inclusion was, you know, generated a lot of good press. It was a very good thing for the firm. The issue was that as president, that shouldn't have been his only focus, particularly if the CEO is going to be someone who's outside trying to bring in more and more business. You need a president who's very quick and focused on the numbers, who's very in the weeds. Of many members of the executive committee who talked to me back then about Joe Gregory, that there was a littleness to him. And he had favorites and he had enemies based on emotions rather than based on cold judgment about their business. The biggest problem with Joe Gregory was that Lehman's sort of motto ever since it had been acquired by American Express and then spun out of American Express was that we are one firm. And this idea of one firm, that we are going to stick together. One firm was what had got them through 9/11 and in fact, all sorts of other crises on Wall Street. Under Joe Gregory's leadership as president, I think what my book shows and the reporting in it shows is that this idea of one firm changes from something being very positive to something very authoritarian and dark and Orwellian. He will not brook dissent or discussion or disagreement on the executive committee. And that becomes a real problem for the people trying to run Lehman Brothers. And Dick Fuld isn't necessarily aware of how much frustration there is with Joe Gregory. He will not listen to people challenging him about the amount of risk that the firm is taking, particularly on real estate.
The portrait you're painting of Joe Gregory makes me suspicious then of his diversity and inclusion initiatives. Aaron Callan was promoted by Joe in an attempt to create more opportunities for women and people of color. Do you think it was perhaps an aspirational hire, or was there something of an agenda behind it?
You know, there is a line about Erin Callan that was said to me by somebody who knew her well, who was senior at the firm, saying, in different circumstances, in a different market, she might have been an absolutely brilliant choice for CFO, because she unquestionably, you know, is extremely talented, extremely bright. The problem was the timing of that appointment. She was made CFO as Wall Street was about to head into an absolutely enormous crisis, and Lehman had an extraordinary amount of risks on its books. And as we now know, the number of lawsuits that Erin Callan got targeted by after Lehman's bankruptcy was enough to make she had to quit her job at Credit Suisse. And that was really the end of her career, because the question became, she had been CFO announcing these results. And, you know, was the question was, had she lied? Or if she hadn't lied, did she know that there was a sort of cover up or a fudging going on? So you ask, you know, should she have been more experienced? I think that what the people around her thought was that if the markets had been smooth and in any other era, it might have been an interesting choice for CFO. The timing turned out to be terrible, because if your CFO and your firm goes bust, you're now in a position of huge responsibility and accountability.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know, with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know, kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Takeoff 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you be enjoying great-tasting dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals that call it home. This is dairy you can feel good about. It's great-tasting, high-quality organic dairy, ethically sourced from small organic family farms. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. That's ov.coop.
You know, right before we began recording, you mentioned that this Lehman story is really one of the difference between economics and anthropology. It sounds like at the heart of Lehman's failure is a small collection of individuals who just weren't up to the task. The risk was too great and the failings too possible. What possible remedies could there be? Because we know that there were plenty of people, Lawrence McDonald, Larry McCarthy, Mike Gelband, Alex Kirk, who were actively campaigning to save the firm they worked at, the firm they loved.
So I don't think it was, not enough talented people. The talented people, as you just pointed out, were there. It's that they weren't given sufficient responsibility and they were out of time, Lindsay. That's, you know, again, when I reread this, things are moving so fast. And, you know, Bart McDade is appointed president way too late for him to be able to really make any meaningful difference. We're already into the last summer. This collection of talent that was there wasn't allowed to do its job. That, I think, is, you know, one of the sadnesses you feel when you read my book, that this tragedy actually could have been averted. And there's no question that there was, you know, that Dick and Joe were blinkered by this idea of having to get the share price up to 150. And above all, they had to beat Goldman Sachs. You know, I describe, a scene in a book where a Goldman Sachs banker says that if they ran into a Lehman banker at a cocktail party, they'd leave. It's some indication of how maybe that this blinkered focus mentality wasn't healthy. I, you know, spent years talking to the former Lehman executives after Lehman had gone. And there was a very strong feeling among them all that, yes, there had been many mistakes made within the firm and that Joe Gregory absolutely was wrong not to listen to the dissenting views of his executive committee, that the appointment of Aaron Callan in hindsight was a mistake, that Dick Fuld should have appointed somebody else as president who really understood the businesses. But at the end of the day, it was precisely because Lehman was viewed by its competitors, particularly Goldman Sachs, as the unwelcome upstart that they ended up failing. And obviously the fact that Hank Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, who they believe let them fail, had run Goldman Sachs. You know, this did not go unnoticed or uncommented on to me by the Lehman guys. I think to this day, many of them think it was terrifically unfair that ultimately only they failed.
Well, you've anticipated the premise of my next question, because Hank Paulson, probably the one man who could have saved Lehman Brothers, was a Goldman man himself. He bailed out AIG, Bear Stearns, a certain man of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, but he did let Lehman fail. Do you think this was a matter of favoritism, of an extension of rivalry, or is there more to the story?
So, again, I think it's really complicated. When you read the book, I did spend time with Hank Paulson, and I could see, I remember actually, as we went through sort of minute by minute what had happened, him really trying in the moment to work through each difficulty as it presented itself in real time. And again, you know, when you make those kind of decisions, you don't have the wisdom of hindsight. And, you know, he was dealing with a pack of dominoes that were falling very fast, one after the other. And there is no question that he was frustrated with Dick Fuld, and he was frustrated with Lehman's arrogance. The spring before Lehman's collapse, Hank Paulson and Dick Fuld had had a meeting. And, you know, I report in the book that what Hank thought he'd told Dick to do in that meeting was a clear warning, was a clear, like, you know, your leverage, your risk is untenable. You need to recapitalize and sort yourself out. You know, this is a real problem. And Dick's memo that he then sent to Tom Russo, Lehman's general counsel, was basically, you're doing a great job. Loved the capital raise we've just done. Keep, Lehman wasn't hearing. And there was, again, frustration from the Treasury with Tom Russo, then the general counsel. They nicknamed him Radio Tom. He transmits, but he doesn't receive. So there was some personal frustration with the fact that they believed Lehman either was deliberately not listening, couldn't hear them, but wasn't doing what the Treasury had told them to do. And I think that they thought, here goes Lehman again, so arrogant. They think that we're just going to bail them out. And I think that you do get that sense on the pages that some of the history does catch up in this moment in September of 2008, that some of the very long-held rivalries, they're not completely forgotten. They are a part of it. But I also think that it's very clear that Hank Paulson tries to put out each fire as it sort of bursts into flame. And so Bear Stearns, it wasn't as dire. The numbers weren't as dire as Lehman. And they were the first sort of domino to fall. And he had JP Morgan. He had a way out for them. But, you know, Jamie Dimon, I report this in the book, is, very much on red alert from that moment on, because he can do it once, he can't do it again. And Fannie and Freddie, again, as I report in the book, were nominally government-sponsored entities. And that was why Hank Paulson felt he had to bail them out. So then by the time you get to Lehman, you do see, as I talk about the events of that last weekend, I mean, Hank Paulson's position is actually that it was the British who let him down. And he had found a solution. He had found a buyer for Lehman Brothers in the form of Barclays. In order for that acquisition to have happened, the British regulator had to green light funding for Lehman on the Monday morning. And they just refused to do that without going through, because they said they would have needed a shareholder meeting. There was just no way. And Paulson was very clear that in his mind, there had been some miscommunication, but he had believed Bob Diamond, who was then running Barclays, had got the British regulator on side. And so there was a lot of finger pointing about what ultimately happened. But as you know, AIG blows up sort of as this is all going on. And they were held to a different standard, not least because the market couldn't sustain AIG failing. It's an insurance company. And you can see why to this day, there are people who say, well, Hank Paulson played the cards he was dealt with. He was out of options when it came to Lehman Brothers. And you know, that he did the best he could, and that, you know, did mistakes get made? It depends which chair you're sitting in, right?
You just said that there was a lot of finger pointing, and certainly there was. But it occurs to me that this story is one of, in a couple of different ways, of government intervention, how the government should or shouldn't have intervened to save the crisis. But there was also finger pointing at the government about how they might have caused the crisis in the beginning. The repeal of Glass-Steagall was, on both sides of the aisle, both decried and revered. The blame for this crisis is probably shared. But I'm wondering, in American politics, who do you think deserves the greatest share of blame for perhaps setting the table and then pushing the crisis to the brink?
The Clinton administration, I think definitely did sort of set the table, and then the Bush administration had to deal with it. Okay, so the blame can go around for everyone. But, a great friend of mine is Gillian Tett, who writes for the Financial Times, who is an anthropologist by training. And she's just written a book called Anthrovision. And because she's an anthropologist, she spends time studying human behavior. And she predicted the financial crisis, not because she was sort of in the weeds looking at numbers and things like that, but because she was sort of studying human behavior. That was this, in a way, the reason for writing The Devil's Casino was because when you read it, what strikes you, I think, is that it's very human. You see this all play out. You see people making decisions based on their character. And, in some ways, the financial crisis came about because the people who make the rules didn't really think about human behavior. The big mistake of the economists was not factoring in how humans will react to regulation, or in this case, or lack of regulation. Credit default swaps, these sort of unregulated financial instruments that had never been tested before, suddenly were tested with absolutely terrible results. But, and all of this arguably could have been averted if people had thought more about, if legislators had thought more about how do humans react in the following circumstances? What happens? So, you know, that's why I think that sort of, you know, I'm not an economist, I am a social historian, but that's why the social histories around this time really matter, actually.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Let's stay in that space because we've certainly survived the crisis, but where are we now? You know, it occurs to me that rules may change, regulations can be relitigated, repealed, and passed, but people often don't change. So, did Wall Street learn its lesson? Have we mitigated the possibility for a future collapse of the same sort? Because many people believe that Wall Street is up to the same tricks.
Well, so there are more regulations and there are stress tests and things like that that the banks have to go through. But, you know, the banks are huge. Too Big to Fail was, you know, the title of Andrew Ross Sorkin's very good book on the financial crisis. You know, and obviously the argument of Lehman Brothers was that the big guys had to be bailed out by the government because otherwise the economic havoc would have just been too great for the world to withstand. Whereas Lehman was just about bearable. And there's no question that the banks are too big to fail. There is just no question. And I think the other thing that really occurs to me, given that I'm now 11 years older than I was when I wrote the Lehman book, is so, you know, everyone around me is 11 years older. Banking is an interesting culture in that it rewards its successful young relatively early on, and then it spits out people, you know, in their late 50s and 60s, unless you're the CEO or a rare exception. It's a young man's profession. And with every generation, we are now living longer. There are many more retired investment bankers playing golf than I think there were 50 years ago, just because there are many, you know, everyone is living longer. But what that does mean is that, again, that memories on Wall Street are short. The institutions now are not filled necessarily with people who remember 2008 and remember the appalling ramifications of taking too much risk. And that, I think, is potentially very troubling. Having said that, the other thing that there's been a cultural shift away from, you know, when I wrote the Lehman book, it was at the sort of end of the glory days of the investment banks. There was a sheen. If you worked at Goldman Sachs or JP Morgan, you know, Morgan Stanley, you know, you were a big deal. And I think that that place in our culture, people are now much more fascinated by Elon Musk's world and the world of the venture capitalists in Silicon Valley and the world of Google and Facebook and these enormous private equity and growth equity firms and some of the hedge funds that, you know, in a way, the innovation space is where I think the cultural fascination when it comes to finance lies right now. And in some ways, there's less scrutiny just sort of culturally, I don't mean politically, you know, when people say I work at Goldman Sachs, I'm not sure it means the same as it did 15 years ago.
Maybe for a final question, let's mine your 11 years of new wisdom here. This is a business show. What do you think the most important business lesson that the average business person, not necessarily a banker, can take away from the story of Lehman Brothers?
Unquestionably, I think it's about the importance of a really strong culture. The relevance and the integrity of that culture needs to be tested, needs to be something that is consciously tested and made sure that it is on the side of good. So, for example, you know, the Lehman idea of one firm at the moment that it was created was a really, really, it's what made Lehman great, unquestionably. If they hadn't all banded together, Lehman wouldn't have survived back in the day, and it was a force for the good. And if there had been a much more rigorous awareness of how important that culture was, an awareness that it was imperative to mean that to make sure that as the times changed and people changed, that that idea was still as positive as it used to be. You know, I think that the idea of loyalty and fighting for each other is unquestionably something that has to be a good principle for a successful business. But at the same time, you have to be a culture where people are not afraid to speak up and say what they think. And so I think that a really strong awareness of what a culture of a business is, what it means, and keeping it moving with the times is really, really, really important, because what ultimately really happened to Lehman was that its culture didn't evolve in the way it needed to, and they paid the ultimate price for that.
Well, Vicky Ward, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you very, very much for having me.
That was my conversation with Vicky Ward. Vicky is a New York Times bestselling author and is also the host and producer of the Audible podcast Chasing Ghislaine. Previously, she was a senior reporter at CNN and the editor-at-large of HuffPost and HuffPost long-form magazine, Highline, and Town & Country magazine. From Wondery, this is one of two interview episodes of The Collapse of Lehman Brothers for Business Members. Be sure to listen to the companion interview with New York Times journalist Peter Eavis. On the next season of Business Movers, in the midst of a financial crisis, former Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz comes back to the company he helped build to save it from the brink of disaster. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Business Movers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today, or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. If you'd like to learn more about Lehman Brothers, we recommend A Colossal Failure of Common Sense, the inside story of the collapse of Lehman Brothers by Lawrence McDonald and Patrick Robinson. The Devil's Casino, Friendship, Betrayal, and the High-Stakes Games Played Inside Lehman Brothers by our guest, Vicky Ward. And Too Big to Fail, the inside story of how Wall Street and Washington fought to save the financial system by Andrew Ross Sorkin. A quick note about our dramatizations. In most cases, we can't know everything that happened, but all our reenactments are based on historical research. Business Movers is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Audio editing by Molly Bach. Sound design by Derek Behrens. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is produced by Stephen Walters. Executive producers are Stephen Walters for Ritual Productions and Jenny Lauer Beckman and Marshall Louie for Wondery.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just three simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.